This podcast was brought to you by our Supreme Boilers of Leather, D. Elton Dane, The New Sword of the Morning, Morgan, and Kate Katchka. If you want to find out how to become a Supreme Boiler of Leather, or if you want access to all the cool bonus materials we offer, head over to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. Today, we are talking about a topic that is far removed from TV series, movies, and Game of Thrones, the books. We are talking about games and game design, and I have a very special guest for this topic today who will now introduce himself.
Hello, everyone. I am Brian Cromrie, the lead designer of the second edition of Company of Heroes, the board game. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And you already dropped several words that we need to clear up for the audience if they are not already informed about what we're talking about, which is Company of Heroes, the board game, which implies there is something else called Company of Heroes on which this board game is based. And then we have a second edition. So let's tackle those in order. What is Company of Heroes, the video game?
Sure. It is basically a squad level. So basically small groups of soldiers, World War II combat game. It's more of a tactical focused, kind of that the small units fighting a smaller scale battle in a smaller area. So a little bit more of that zoomed in approach for those interested in that kind of thing.
But there is a strategic aspect of resource development to it as well.
Yeah, I think that's where it really steps apart from, I would say, more in the board gaming industry from a typical war game. It kind of approaches more of what people call RTS, which is a real-time strategy game. It really has that real-time aspect to it. And it's kind of in this gray space where, like, coming from, like, historically, RTS is a lot where more about gathering resources and less about just that pure fighting over the board. And I think Company Heroes was one of the ones that really, that whole series, starting with the first one in the series, really pioneered that whole capturing objectives on the map. They call them capture points, and just kind of holding them. And it was a little bit more focused on that. And that gave you resources rather than, you know, a little bit more that grandiose, hey, we're just here to capture some resources and fight over them. So it's a little bit different angle, I'd say.
It's good that you mentioned this in-between space where the game finds itself, because I have been searching for something like this for a very long time. I do remember, I don't know if you were around in video gaming back then, but in 1999, there was this game called Sudden Strike, if I remember correctly, which tried something at least partially similar, but you always started with a set amount of units and they just dwindled down during the course of the game, which is realistic, of course, because as a commander, you usually don't build units on the battlefield, which is always this Command and Conquer or Warcraft or Starcraft contraption that they're using. This didn't click for me. You know, I would have liked a more realistic approach to tactics and strategy, but not on the granular level that these war games provided. And the same is true for board games as well. I have never been a war gamer. I just cannot get myself into this genre. It's too granular for me, too focused on the simulation. And in the computer game space, Company of Heroes, the first one came out in 2006, I believe, and the second one in 2012. And I logged way over 1,500, I think my Steam profile says, in Company of Heroes 2. So I played a lot of it. Now we have Company of Heroes 3, but time has become more limited as I got older. So I'm not as well-versed in Company of Heroes 3 than I was in 2. And one. But this is this in-between space, you know, of controlling territory, which gives you resources, and then you spend those resources into troops. So there is both aspects of it. And the same again is true in board gaming. There are board games with a higher level of abstraction that usually let you gather resources and build troops. But then the fighting aspect is usually a very strategic one, like a rock, paper, scissors model or something like this, because the aspect is more on the strategic level. And then you have tactical board games in which you usually do have very complicated units, but you cannot produce them or anything. And Company of Heroes sits right in between. So, do you know anything about the genesis of the game? Because you are not the lead designer of the first edition, but of the second one. And the first edition was developed by Chris, the founder of Bad Crow Games. Can you tell us a little bit about how that worked?
Sure, I'm going to be able to just fill in the details I know, and then I'll kind of let you know the stuff I don't know. So coming from Bad Crow Games, I do know essentially his path was he created basically a game called Serpent's Tongue. It was kind of a little bit more of like a Magic the Gathering style game, and then he moved on to Mech Command RTS. And that one really focused on actual real-time play where you'd actually use a timer and everyone would make their move simultaneously during that time. And in the board gaming industry, that's actually not that popular. I think a lot of people look towards the board gaming industry to step away from that and have time to think and time to make decisions. So for I think that's for the main reason why real time's not that popular. So I think he kind of took that model with Company of Heroes and just really kind of developed it, spent a lot of time tuning it and just matching the video game as much as possible. And I think he had a pretty good product for first edition. Just needed, in my opinion, when I joined the team, I was just like, man, this is going to need an insane amount of play testing to get at that level of polish that I think the top games in the industry really hold. And I think you can see a difference, but I think when I joined, it was just really seeing that potential there.
I absolutely do agree on the need for polishing and the need for play testing as well. This is one aspect of game design in video games as well as in board games that seems undervalued by many people to me. They simply do not realize what amount of play testing you need. You cannot be a brilliant game designer and just essentially fart out a game and then it's perfect. It doesn't work that way. It's the same with most art. There are very few artists who are capable of just writing a novel and the first draft is it. There's constantly reworking and then when you have TV or movies, there's focus group testing and different versions and all that kind of stuff. And it's the same with games. You need to test them and you need to test them very thoroughly. To get something out of it that is actually good. And when you say, like, first edition needed more play testing, is this a very tacit attack on the original design crew that they neglected that? Or is there another reason for the problems of first edition?
Well, I think in board gaming industry as a whole, especially when you're, just getting your feet wet in publishing and game development, is, first of all, you're starting small, you have a small team. The biggest problem really is just finding play testers, and you don't really have any form of investment from the community yet, right? So I think like it was just a night and day difference between first edition. Once you go to Kickstarter, which we, I think you wanted to touch on later, but once you go to that and you actually get investors like the community, these backers that are like, oh, I want this game, I want this product, now they're invested, right? Because they put money on the table for something they don't have yet. So now they're well naturally a lot more invested in, hey, I want this product to be the best product possible. So then those people are more willing to play test. So it's kind of a weird scenario, I think, for a lot of Kickstarters, especially small publishers when they're first getting in the industry. I think once they're established in the industry, they can kind of get more, they kind of get like their fans that are fans of their, games and their line of games and the type of games they make, that they can kind of rely on those play testers to kind of help. Because it's really it's an insane amount, the amount of work that needs to go in that. And the biggest thing I just want to point out is just it's just exponential. you know, you think when you're making a little bit more complex of a game and a little bit more complex of a game, you add a little component here or something here, mechanic there, the amount of testing is really just, you know, that's needed to get it to that state is just exponential. It just keeps compounding on itself. And then that doesn't help itself when it's a medium to longer game too, as well. Like the short little games that are 10, 15 minute games, you can get so many games in a typical session, right? So there's just a lot of factors that compound themselves in game development, I would say.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I have tried to develop games of my own, and they always failed after the first draft. You know, you get a first draft out, and then you realize that many of the things you created just don't work, and that you would need to play it over and over, and then you usually give up because there's no scenario in which you can do that as a hobbyist and as an amateur. And I think many people have butted their heads against this, you know, try to mod an existing game, like making up rules for chess where the bishops can shoot lasers or something like that. And then you realize your rule just doesn't really work out in the game. And with Company of Heroes, as you said, we have a very complex game. There are five factions in it. Each faction has like 20 different units or something to that effect. You can upgrade them with two different modular upgrades per unit usually. You have commanders that add abilities. You have different terrain types, etc., etc. So there are many, many moving components. And as you said, the more moving components you have, the more difficult it becomes to actually balance this. However, I would push back a little bit, because I think the biggest difference from first edition to second edition, which covers your tenure, isn't so much in the balancing of details, like if the King Tiger has a slow die or not, or if a unit has one health or a defense die or whatever, but it is more in the general structure of the game round. Because in Company of Heroes, what you do, or what you did in first edition, is to take these little smaller broken up turns. You have command points, which allow you to command your units, and you send them over the map like this. And in the first edition, correct me if I'm wrong, everyone had 9 of those. And it was impossible to ever occupy a place in which an enemy unit stood. And these two factors lent themselves to a very static gameplay, which you strived to make much more dynamic in second edition. Would that be broadly correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly correct. I think when you look at kind of a game design, when you're choosing the mechanisms, each mechanism that you kind of choose is going to have its strengths and weaknesses. And I think that's where game design usually falters, is really at the beginning, is really just choosing what mechanisms are needed. And I would say this is actually what sets Company of Heroes apart, was the simplicity of just putting a cube on the board. You're calling them command cubes or command points or whatever, and you just move a unit one spot on the board. And I think a lot of other, like kind of what you were saying before, in this kind of space in between war games and stuff, where that's not really done. Normally, unit just moves whatever its movement value is, could be 1, could be 3, whatever, and then it's done, and then you don't touch it, and maybe you have to mark an exhaustion token or something on it, and you have, you know, a lot more units. Where Company of Heroes, again, it's that smaller scale battles, where first edition had a little bit fewer units, and I'd actually say this was one of, again, the strengths, but yet weaknesses of the system, is that it's so simple. And so, like, you have so much fine-tuned control as a player of the game that, hey, I just want to move this unit one, this one I want to spend, you know, my next turn all three cubes on. You just get a lot of, it sounds so basic and simple of, hey, I just have these three cubes, how do I spend them? But yeah, I mean, that 9 cube limit, I think it was funny, because when I first brought it up early on in second edition, Chris was like very much against it. I was like, no, that it's got to be 9. Anything more than 9 is too much. And from a board game, I think that's one of the key things to look at, is you don't want everyone to be able to do everything, right? Because then what's the point of having command cubes? A lot of games, for instance, in this space, let you just move everything. It's your turn. Just move all your units up to their movement value, and then, you know, fight or, you know, have combat. And I think that's where the elegance of the system comes in, is that it kind of forces these tough decisions of what sides of the battlefield do you want to move forward, which ones, you know, are more important than others to you right now. You have to make these tactical decisions. And it is, right? So like you're saying that 9 is too constraining, and it certainly is in second edition for sure. In first edition, it was possibly a little bit, but that's part of the design, right? It's about making those choices, and a lot of factors come in, right? So map size, how many, you know, units do you have, how far across the board you need to move your units. So there's definitely a lot of factors that, you know, when you're coming into game design, it's really like, oh yeah, this is a simple thing of just moving units. But when you start to realize like you have all these other constraints that you kind of have to do the best you can and then, you know, work from there in a lot of ways.
The simplicity that you mentioned is one of the big draws of this game for me, because as you said, many war games are incredibly complex and the table space gets very cluttered. I'm always amazed at when I set up a game of Company of Heroes that I do not have many tokens lying around. I have practically no cards on the table, which is also very unusual. Usually you have a lot of cards that give you additional information, which is obviously very hard to read for your opponent on the other side of the table, which increases the difficulty level because you need to actually know what your opponent does and you need to know it by heart because you cannot read this stuff all the time. And what Company of Heroes does is to basically visualize all information in dice, which show different sides, and which you just put next to your units on little trays. And so I could put a dice on a side with a little man on it, and that signifies additional damage against infantry. Or you have a die with a fire symbol on it, which, wouldn't you have guessed it, is fire damage. And this is a much easier and much more visually rewarding thing than I would have initially thought, to be honest. Because when I first read about this concept back in the time of the first edition Kickstarter, it seemed like a very weird choice that put me off, because I couldn't imagine it on the table. And it seemed like the game was much lighter than it actually is. Now I know, having wisened up in the meantime, that this is actually a point very much in its favor. But I feared that it, in the beginning, because of this dice and because there is so little extra stuff, that this was a very light game masquerading as a heavy one, where in truth, it is a very heavy one that is doing its darned best to present itself as lightly as possible and to reduce clutter. It's a very well thought out game design, in my opinion. And I mean, everyone will have noticed by now, but I'm a big fan of this game. Sorry for the fawning all over it, but I really think this is a brilliant piece of game design. So do you know how Chris got the idea of the dice in the first place?
That I don't know, because I would say when I first saw it as well, because I was a first edition backer, and then I shortly joined the team after. But I was actually put off. I'm like, man, my first thought was, that's got to be expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're normally, yeah, there's just normally what's called chit tokens, these little punch board, or I always call them like cardboard. They're very close to cardboard, just with like kind of a layer that you can print over. And yeah, that's normally used, especially in this kind of space, to do that type of thing. And not in just war games, but all throughout board gaming. So to use the die, it's both genius and costly. So it's like, you know, something where in the Kickstarter space, where you can have these more deluxe games, you kind of get a little bit more freedom in that range where you can kind of look at these options. And I actually love the die. I think it's a great idea, but I think that's kind of a big issue, kind of like you're saying, on it's kind of a strength of the design in a lot of ways. That's kind of a big issue in any game with miniatures, right? So miniatures are a huge selling point of the game, but unfortunately they just visually show you something, but they don't give you the exact, what, you know, it's called stats. Like what's the exact values, what's the strengths and weaknesses of that unit just by looking at it, you know, unless you know the game and you're familiar with the game. So things like dice do, you know, how it's used here in Company of Heroes does show the upgrades, but even still, there is still a little bit of a learning curve there with learning the units, learning kind of like, hey, you know, the base value of sight is 2. So every unit by default has a sight of 2. And there are certainly things that you kind of have to have some kind of knowledge base of to build off of. And it's not perfect. No system's perfect. I actually think that's kind of one of the bigger weaknesses as you kind of see a lot of games. Like, I've watched hundreds of games now as developing second edition, and just seeing for the new players, just, you know, what are your stats? What can that unit do? And that kind of that learning curve, you know, it is a little bit with, you know, just learning all the units. And that's kind of why I typically recommend just picking one of the basic easy factions like US or Wehrmacht, and just playing against each other and trying to learn those units there.
Yeah, that is true. But I mean, the learning curve you have for every game. Try teaching Twilight Imperium to someone and you know what I mean. Or really any other complex board game. It just comes with the territory. When you put a table hog out like this, you know, with all the miniatures and the stuff, and you have a playtime of, like, it can easily run into 4, 5, 6 hours, depending on player count and how long people think, etc. You just have to have this kind of investment. If someone complains about, oh, I have to learn the values of units, or the rules are complicated and I can't keep them all in my head after one explanation, it's just not that kind of game. Unless you are a master of memory, you will never be able with these kinds of games to get one explanation and then just go, got it, I can play it now. It's just too complex for that. You need to have multiple games. And that is where we come into the problematic territory of time and that you have mentioned for the playtesting. Because this also comes with the territory. A lot of people cannot afford or do not afford the playtesting that is necessary to actually balance this in a good way. And I think this is the Achilles heel of a lot of Kickstarter projects. And this is a good time as any to go into what exactly is Kickstarter. If you have never heard about it, it's not restricted to the board gaming space, but it really thrived with board games. So could you go into a little explanation of what it is and try to explain it from a production company's point of view, what is actually the value of a Kickstarter?
So Kickstarter's kind of, it was about a decade ago now, maybe slightly more at this point, kind of hit the board game industry as kind of a new option where, first of all, like, first-time creators can bypass the kind of the typical traditional model of, hey, I have a board game design, let me, you know, work on this board game design, and then let me reach out to an existing publisher and try to pitch to them my product. And that process, I could tell you, just simply not fun. You know, I think that's, you know, across any industry where you do that, whether it's like writing a book or this or that, you know, you're soliciting, right? It's just certainly not fun. And that's almost a different talent. You know, that's certainly a different talent in a lot of ways than just making the product itself, right? So there's just so many different other hurdles you go. And, you know, some people, you know, more, you know, historically at that point, were looking to maybe make their own publishing company, and you need the funds. And I think that's kind of the biggest issue, is really just the funding of the traditional model was for retail, was to have the funding, have the money to order. You have your game, you're finished it, you're done with it, you're ready to go. And then you order so many copies of it, whether it's 500, 1,000, 1,500, et cetera, to have that starting base. And then you try to, you know, sell it out in the industry. And again, that could typically be, historically, that was in retail stores, right? And then, you know, with online, that kind of switched. But now with Kickstarter, allowed individuals, or, you know, groups of, you know, whatever, teams, if you want to call it, to kind of bypass that and really reach out directly to kind of potential customers, whether, again, that's board gaming or any industry. But I think it's a little bit different in board gaming than, say, video gaming. I think board gaming is a little bit more understood that, hey, this is going to cost money to make. It is a physical product. I'm not just getting something digitally as it is nowadays with video games. So I think it's just viewed a little bit differently with board games. But again, it kind of allows, you know, board game designers, you know, publishers to kind of take a different approach and get the funding from the community, kind of like a, it's almost like a pre-order system, although everyone like wants to shun calling it a pre-order system, but it is kind of like that. It's also shifted a bit over the years too. I think when it first started out, the bar was lower. It was more of like, hey, let's kind of like Kickstarter is for other industries where, hey, let's just, I had this idea. I need money to get it off the ground. Where nowadays the board game industry, it's really expected that you have such a high level polished product at a certain stage of development that already, like, you already needed money to get there. You already needed time and money and resources to get there because people are expecting this high level of polish. So Kickstarter itself is kind of an interesting thing, you know, just that community based, you know, crowdfunding that really is now kind of, you know, it's almost like 50-50, you know, a lot of the top games, is it Kickstarter or is it retail? And it's not quite, I don't think it's quite 50-50 yet, but I mean, in a lot of ways, it's the, a lot of the bigger games are Kickstarter games nowadays, because they kind of, like I was saying before, they get to break a lot of that retail model mold and go through other avenues, like more expensive games, right? More niche games. So that's kind of one benefit I'd say of a Kickstarter over a retail.
Hey, it seems there is this platonic ideal of Kickstarter where the community funds a project it has a passion for and people come together, etc. And then you have the cold reality that to actually get people to pledge money over this is to treat it as a sort of pre-order system. And these two systems, they are at odds. Because Kickstarter always says, like, when you put money in there, you do not get anything in return legally. Like, you are promised so-called, the lingo is rewards. For example, I give you Bad Crow Games, I give you $600, and so you will reward me with a game later. But I do not enter into a binding contract. And I'm informed about this at every stage, but it is understood that this is just so much legalese. The expectation is that when I give money over Kickstarter, that I will receive a product down the line at the specified time, which is also something that Kickstarter cannot guarantee and that companies over Kickstarter cannot guarantee for obvious reasons. But it has morphed into this understanding. And I would assume this is kind of a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in that people are willing to invest these sums of money. Like when it comes to Company of Heroes, the board game, if you go all in, what's the current price tag? Like $650 for everything, the complete package?
Yeah, around there. Yep.
So I don't do this on a whim to support a project I think is cool. You know, that I do with $10 or $15, but I'm not doing it with $650. And so I do expect a certain level of product coming out of it. And as you mentioned, for this, you need to be able to present something that is believably going to go there. So if you look at any Kickstarter campaign right now for these kinds of board games, you know, the 3-digit price tags, you will see the miniatures, or at least prototypes of the miniatures are already there. Prototypes, very advanced prototypes of the components, like cards and tokens, boards. You will have a version of the rules already finished, usually. So very obviously, they have to have gone months of development into it. And this means that the flashy Kickstarters that are concentrating all the money on them, those are the fewest Kickstarters, but they are, I don't want to say corner, but they are concentrating a lot of the money that is made, is to be made on Kickstarter on them. And most Kickstarters fail because nobody ever sees them or pledges anything. And the big companies are taking away a lot of oxygen. And of course, we are talking about board games here. So big companies is very relative. But I think the strategy that Bad Crow Games chose is to consciously go after a license that comes with a built-in customer base. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly basically board game, Bad Crow Games model when it comes to board games. Because kind of like I was touching on before, especially when you're new to the space, you also then have the marketing aspect and then like a fan base or player base that, how do you reach those individuals, right? So that's kind of a problem, especially, you know, another problem when you're starting out as a board game publisher, especially, is how do you reach those individuals? And just like, you know, many other markets nowadays, board gaming has become, it's kind of going through a boom, if you will, in some ways, but that kind of boom has a lot of downsides in that board gaming itself has a lot of oversaturation. So yes, everything out there is being made under the moon, but also how do you stand out, right? So again, and how do you, you know, get those eyes on your product? Because that's really the hardest job of all in a lot of ways, because a lot of games really succeed at that angle and then they have an inferior product. And a lot of times those games actually do better financially, even if their game's not that great, because as you kind of stated, this game's not out there. It's kind of like just someone backing a dream, if you will, of getting something, you know, made. So it's kind of interesting out there, like what the different options are. But yeah, I would say for us at Bad Crow, that's kind of been the motto for Chris, is just kind of leaning on IPs, just the intellectual properties of video games in particular, has been, you know, our motto to try to get, you know, that kind of the existing base, like you said.
Yeah, you mentioned a very important problem for both sides, because you now developed it from the production company's point of view. How do you get eyeballs on a project? But I, as the customer, have the problem of needing to judge a game on an unfinished, very polished, but as of yet, it's just a promise. It's a design sketch. It's I don't know what the word for this is, like. Yeah, a design sketch. Let's keep it at that. And if it is any good or not, I can usually not tell. The Tabletop Simulator has helped a little bit with that, which is a online platform that simulates a board game table. And if the production company invests even more money and produces a module for this Tabletop Simulator, people can try out their game in a simulated 3D space. And this is obviously something that you used for player feedback to simulate game after game after game in the second edition, which we should mention isn't out yet. It has been playtested to the tune of thousands of games, but there is no physical copy of it anywhere in the world, aside from your prototypes, I guess. But for me, it can be hard to discern if something is worth it. And in the beginning of the Kickstarter boom, plastic miniatures are what sold games, and they still are up to a point, but by now they have become from this unique selling thing, like, oh my god, when you have the first games from Cool Minis or Not, which is a production company, actually, they're Come On Games, Cool Mini or Not, and their whole selling point, as the name implies, is we have cool minis. And for a time that was sufficient. By now, everyone has cool minis. If you tell me, oh, there's a Kickstarter out and it has cool minis, I'm going, yeah, what else is new? Every Kickstarter now has cool minis. That is expected now. So you need to stick out with more stuff, and IPs generally help with that. But then a lot of people have always used IPs to hide inferior products. If you go back in video game history, for example, I mean, there is this infamous E.T. game from Atari or an early Jurassic Park game that were atrociously bad, but sold a huge amount of copies just because of the name recognition. And it can be hard to discern this. And if I'm spending like $500-$600 on a board game, I really want to know it's good before I pull the trigger.
Yeah, certainly on that note, yeah, a lot of companies are investing nowadays in options like, you know, the digital implementations, right? If this, here's our prototype, you can check it out, whether it's Tabletop Simulator, Tabletopia, there's so many out there nowadays. You know, so there's some web browser based ones, just to show what my product is so people can test it out. Because what's actually funny about it is a lot of it still is just only a small number of people that even back a project will even test it. A lot of it is that kind of that leap of faith, you know, believing in a product or the hype of the product or what that promise is, if you will. And they kind of rely on those few individuals, or, you know, percentage wise at least, that kind of tests the product and then review the product, and, you know, we call them previews and reviews, and there's kind of gray space there, especially when a game's not finalized yet and is only in prototype form. But yeah, I mean, it is quite interesting to see, because that is kind of one benefit that sometimes Kickstarters do have over retail. And a lot of times retail games don't have that option, right? Because they're that more traditional model. So you're just looking maybe at a, you know, a store or website online, just looking at the back of the box. Or maybe you're looking, again, the same similar model. You're looking at videos online of previews of people who got an advanced copy or what they think. So a lot of it in board gaming is, unless you go out and you play, you know, you wait until someone already has a copy. And I'd say that's kind of one thing with second edition that we benefited from, right? We've established ourselves with the first edition that, hey, here's our product, right? It's pretty good, right? And what's rare in the board gaming industry is to get a second edition. So when something like gets a second edition, that actually has a lot of implications that maybe the community doesn't know, but there's a lot more development time and money and stuff going into it. It's almost like making a new product in a lot of ways from the ground up. Yeah, you still have some assets and stuff saved over, but in a lot of ways, again, it's kind of more of a new product in a lot of ways. So it's kind of, I don't want to say like an honor or a badge of privilege or whatever you want to call it, but to show that, like, hey, we have a second edition, we have an established product, there is a, you know, existing market for this product, I think does reassure people as well. So you have that, like, hey, you have this existing product, it was successful, clearly it must have been, why would you be making a new edition of it unless you know that there's more people out there or existing backers that kind of want that, you know, updates or the new edition.
Have you ever had people who felt shafted because they backed first edition and then you make a second edition, which is of course much better and improved, and they're saying like, hey, why didn't I get the better and improved project in the first place? Feeling cheated a little bit?
I think that's fair, but I think, you know, I think there's going to be some out there that feel that way. And I think that's completely fair. I think to anyone that's, you know, fully understandable, but in it, with any product, right? So any product that doesn't meet your expectations, you know, kind of, let me ask you as the listener, would you rather have something that isn't good or isn't good enough to meet your standards? Or would you like something like, hey, you know, kind of like a customer support model, like, hey, we this game is good, but it isn't like quite meeting your expectations. Let me try to rectify that, right? So let me give you an option, like, hey, we've got a lot more feedback now. We're improving the product, and here's a new improved product, right? And also, like, here's just an update kit, like we offered, where boom, now you can get your second edition because you had the product. For quite reasonable, right? And I think we try to definitely take that into consideration when we made second edition. We're like, listen, we understand, you know, we're appreciative that you kind of, the first edition backers made the whole product possible, right? So this, like, without them, we wouldn't be here making the second edition. So we kind of really offered that almost at cost. I know it sounds crazy, but like the lowest profit of anything we have. You know, you keep mentioning that $650 mark, but coming in, the first edition 4-player core box back then was undervalued it. It's kind of Chris's, you know, really came in at that $100 mark to offer 4 factions. And now second edition, yeah, there's inflation and all these things, and it certainly run rampant the last few years, but especially in the board gaming industry, which kind of like the inflation compounded as how it got impacted. But now it's like, hey, now you're in the $200 plus mark for a 4-faction bundle, right? So you kind of run into this scenario where, you know, you got to make a profit at the end of the day. But then like the update kit, I think we offered for $49 or $50. So really, that's just so much content in there that, you know, like, again, you're saying the $650 mark, and, you know, the first edition was several hundred dollars for everything, right? But you don't need everything. That's kind of the one thing that I want to state with Company of Heroes is coming in just a 2-player core set for, we targeted that now. We reduced it from 4 to 2, but we still targeted that $100 mark, right? So that's one thing that you can still get hours and hours and hours of enjoyment out of at kind of a reasonable price point. So Just want to kind of throw that out there.
That's true. I do not know how representative I am with this mindset, but I am always, when I buy stuff, be it board games or a new car or whatever, I do know that if I choose a lesser version, like fewer extras or from a cheaper with less functions, like if I have choice between an oven that is actually great and I know it's great, and then I have the option to buy a less great one that is cheaper, I know that I am constantly, every time I use the cheaper oven, I will wish I had the more expensive one. And the same is true for me, at least in board games. If I did not bag everything like this, I would constantly beat myself up about the stuff I don't have, which is very dangerous from a point of view of the health of my pocket. But this is how I roll, which is why I have to be extremely discriminating in what I actually back, and to develop a kind of alarm system, you know, to recognize red flags in the Kickstarter. And I think that is a skill that many players needed to develop over these last years, to kind of weed out the bad Kickstarters from the beginning. And I think I am by now pretty well versed in recognizing, on the one hand, if something is just basically a cash grab, like they have cool minis and nothing else. And on the other hand, which is equally as important, may be a good game, but not for me. You know, you need to be able, from looking at these presentations and maybe the rule book and a few how to play videos, to discern if this game would bring you enjoyment. It might perfectly be fine for other people. So, for example, I'm pretty sure Agricola is a great board game, but it is not for me, or Puerto Rico or stuff like that. I just don't like this kind of game. They're good games, but they're not for me. And you need to be able to see that from a product that is not yet available. Whereas in ye olden times, you would have someone who owns the game. He would give you a demo presentation, and then you would know for certain. But this is not viable in the Kickstarter market because, yeah, some of them are available in retail later on, but many games are not. Like, this is one of the big questions. If someone is now engrossed by what we're talking about and wants to have Company of Heroes second edition, I'm not even sure if they can anymore because the backing time of the Kickstarter is over. So this is, of course, your opportunity for a commercial break.
On that note, it is kind of funny, right? Because we couldn't close the pledge manager. Luckily, we did find a few retailers that were interested. So we are going to have a little bit of retail distribution. But again, that's kind of a different model out there. All said and done, there are going to be some, like I said, retailers, especially in the US and Canada. And I think, I'm not sure exactly where Blackfire Games is. I'm not too familiar with them, but we've been working with them. Hopefully, we can get everything squared away with them. But yeah, I mean, some copies are going to be available probably on our web store, you know, the extra copies at the end of the day when we've kind of delivered to all the Kickstarter backers. But that's pretty much it and kind of that front of that product. And who knows what's going to happen in the future, right? Because that's kind of another downside of the IP as well, is that even if we want to, you know, reprint, if you will, just print it out again, we have to get a, you know, license extension, right? So that's, you know, probably something that we're very likely going to pursue, hopefully, and, you know, hopefully it comes to fruition. But that's kind of another kind of downside of IP games, is you kind of do run into that FOMO a bit. A lot of times the licensing agreement, you know, it's kind of riskier the more reprints you do, because obviously your target audience, is it growing, right? Because kind of that question you're saying, like, hey, did you show it to your friend and now they want a copy? Or you know like how much is your growth of like breaking into the world of finding new backers, right? Kind of that marketing after the fact versus already saturation, right? Just that saturation concept of, hey, we already found everyone that wants it. So it's very tough, right? So I think Company of Heroes is, I think, a great product. I think we've put a lot of effort into it, and hopefully you can at least check it out. We do have it on, like, it's already been mentioned, on a Tabletop Simulator. If you have access to that, you can check it out there. And we'll see what comes in the future. I mean, I would love to work more on it. I already have some cool ideas. Hopefully they can come to pass, but we'll see.
I mean, this is a problem that board games have in common with tabletop RPGs, which is only one player at the table needs to have the product. If I want to play Company of Heroes 3, for example, with my friends, everyone needs to have bought it because else we can't play. But to play a game of Company of Heroes, the board game, it suffices that I have spent all that money. None of my friends needs to do the same. So there is a natural limit to the market. Because I might convince many people that this is a great game and they will agree with me emphatically, but they would never buy it because why would they? I am the guy they play it with and I have it. So I can imagine this is a very tough thing, especially to estimate because there is little data to go on, right? So having put out these more commercial aspects of the whole thing, how do you approach stuff as a game designer? And I mean, you are... I don't know if I could call it a full-time game designer. I think you mentioned that you're doing it like part-time next to a regular job, but still you're doing it on a professional paid level. So what would you describe is the thought process and the general challenge of game design?
Well, on that very note, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the interesting part is that I have a full-time job and really I've been at kind of just that hobby level. And I'm actually looking to hopefully pursue it more at that professional level. But that's kind of the first note is that, you know, when it comes to game design, there isn't really money there. I know it sounds crazy when you, especially when you see these Kickstarter numbers, but there really isn't money there for game designers, right? The margins are just so small and very few game designers can actually do it full time. So to kind of pursue it, right? So I almost kind of view it that, yeah, you can some a lot of the team of Bad Crow is, you know, part-time just because they have real, you know, full-time jobs, right? So to possibly have two full-time jobs is kind of where I'd be looking at, right? That's kind of where I'd want to be at going in the future. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? So... Sorry, but what was the rest of your question with just like more of the game design process?
Yeah, what is your process? How do you approach it? What would you say you have learned?
Well, there's definitely a lot to learn, especially if you're new coming in. I think the first few things coming in to learn is that you know you have to just really try to just, I'd say play a lot of games out there, just really just volume. And figure out what interests you and almost just take a game design and just tweak it at first, right? Just kind of what's called make a variant, right? So just kind of like, hey, I don't like this rule, fix it, right? And see if that interests you. And that's kind of what I'd say as a game designer. But what I kind of personally learned is that, man, there's just infinite learning. I know it sounds crazy, right? So like you can kind of see it with some board game designers that, you know, hey, here's their game. And sometimes there's a board game designer that has like they're like a one hit wonder. They, you know, they made this game and that's it. And then you don't hear from them again. And I think that is a little bit, there is a lot to board game design where sometimes it's kind of like that lightning rod, like the lightning in a bottle, right? Sometimes you just catch the magic and it just, you got that one game that just works. Right. And I think that's actually very true. I'd say in the board game industry.
Yes, there are some names out there that really can establish themselves, like Richard Borg, for example. But those are few, I feel. Very few people are making big names in this industry. And if you think about what you actually did for Company of Heroes, would you describe this? Because you said like a second edition is like a new game. Did you make a variant? Or did you make a new game? Or what exactly did you do?
That's actually kind of funny because it started out basically like, hey, we're calling it 1.5. And like, how do we just tinker some things and just fix it, right? How do we just, hey, you know, make it better for the players? And, you know, here's some updated cards and, you know, here's the updated stats for the units. And maybe here's a rule or two difference, right? So that's kind of where I would call like the variant territory. Like, hey, let's just fix, you know, just a surface level skim. Let's fix it and let's get it out there, right? So a lot of times you'll see that. I mean, it's very common, like just what's called in the video game industry, just a patch, right? Oh, here's some patches and boom, you're done, right? Whereas I think once you cross that mark of, no, like we really need to sink a lot of time into this and effort into this, that it really becomes its own product, right? So like you could say, it's common, it's kind of funny, very common in the board game industry is take other people's ideas and then kind of make them your own with slight twists and this and that, where there isn't really too many twists of existing stuff that we took from first edition. It was really just like, hey, how do we address this concern, like turn order? Or like you mentioned already, like, hey, how can I, you have this point that I want to capture. How can I move my unit onto yours? And that's probably, you know, we call it assault. That's kind of the most complicated rule we have in there. And a lot of people have questions on it. And, you know, rightfully so. It's got a full page with some examples and some key points to hammer home. But that is kind of like, hey, you have like a simple concept. Like, hey, can I just move my unit where yours is? Sounds simple enough, but it has a lot of rules, right? So sometimes I think that's a very tough thing too, is trying to figure out the right line for complexity, because yeah, sir, you know, you could fix a lot of things, but if you keep adding and adding and adding and adding, then all of a sudden your game is too complicated for, you know, all but the very few to play, right? So it is definitely a tough thing where you definitely want to find the right balance of tuning it to what it needs to do. And you want to cut as many rules as possible and streamline it. And is this rule worth it? And I think we kind of hit that ceiling there with Company Heroes.
Yeah, I would agree there. I found it fascinating to be a part of this from a purely observing perspective. But just I could observe some things in real time. I backed it, I think, in last March 2022. And have been active on the Discord and the community ever since. And I saw you like announcing this new change or that new change. And it was incredibly fascinating to see how the game developed. For example, one iteration of the rules, which is a very minor point, it's like just one sentence in the rules, but it has huge repercussions on how the game plays, is that you suddenly decided that units can move through each other. Because for a long time, I could not move my units through enemy units. And then you suddenly decided, no, you can't do that. And that changed the dynamic of the game in a very profound way, although it's only one sentence in the rules. So if you take just that example, which is a very common thing, every strategy game has to decide, can you move through enemy pieces or can't you? Because it's usually understood that you cannot end up in the same space as something else for physical reasons alone. How did this come about and how did you approach this? How long did you think about it? Was it like a flash of genius that just came to you? Or was it a painstaking process of trying out and debating it?
I'm going to touch on this. So this is a great example. I'm glad you thought of this one. Because a lot of times when like you do something like this one, like you said, line example, like one sentence, it's a little change. And then you'll get people like, oh, man, why this rash change all of a sudden? And very, very rarely, especially this late, do you get a rash change. Right. So it's not like abrupt either. You know, it's not like sometimes you'll find things like, oh, hey, I see this happening and it needs some tuning here or there. But in this example, it was something that we kind of saw over the course of throughout first and second edition, right? So a lot of times you run into this thing where someone would just throw a unit in the way, so you just can't move past them. So even with the fix, right, we kind of touched it on already where, hey, with the new rule of assault, you can move on to another unit, which, like you said, has physical restrictions, right? So I think that a lot of times in board games, you kind of run into these questions like, hey, is this a rule? Can you move onto the same spot as others? Oftentimes it's not because of that physical limitation, but we just kind of squish everything in that hex and say, all right, battle to the death, kind of. It's not quite that way, but it kind of works that way, right? So we add that rule, and you can kind of see over time that it does address that issue with, because you have capture points in the game that are called victory points, and that's kind of the big way to win the game. So when you have one on like the outskirts of the map and there's kind of only one way to get there, all of a sudden you're getting units that are not defending that victory point, but they're just getting in your way. right? And if you can't move through them, yeah, okay, now I have to stop and assault you. Now I can't, this round, I can't get to where I wanted to, even if it's one hex away. So to me, I just call it what I would call gaming the game, right? Like, that's kind of what I call it. I know some people don't like it that, and some people like think you should game the game, right? So there's definitely different perspectives on this one in particular, where I'm just like, I don't like that in the game. I want the whole point of all these rules and changes is so that you have to fight over the point. And if I win the point, I get the victory point, right? So I think that's what it really came down to, is that I don't want units to be able to block me from getting that, especially like the last round of the game, right? You want to look for those climactic finishes, who you know was able to pull it off, right? And if, oh, I just blocked you, now you can't get there, you lose. You know, it doesn't matter what you can do, you can't fight me. Even if you destroy my unit, you can't move there, right? So it just that's what it comes down to, right? It just comes down to, let's get those most climactic finishes, right? And that's that kind of almost, you know, I don't want to run on, but that kind of goes on to the rule of what I saw. It was kind of, it made me shudder when I first saw it. I never saw this before in the game, but I think it was like fall 2021 or winter 2021. I saw a game where these two very, you know, consistent playtesters throughout this whole time period, still to this day, they're good buddies. They play quite often. One of them was in the lead, and their only way to lose was if they lost units, because units also reward victory points. So if they didn't lose any units, no matter what, they would win the game. So they just literally the last round of the game just retreated all of their units. And I was just like slapping my head. I'm like, I got to do something. Like, this is just horrible, right? It kind of goes against that climactic finish that we really wanted to focus on. So just a small tweak there, I just want to touch on as well, kind of goes hand in hand, that whoever has the most victory capture points gets 3 bonus victory points. So some small change like that, it's another very small change. You're just coming in with a scalp, as I like to call it, coming in with a scalpel, doing something precise, and then boom, now you change the game, where now that person falls back, the opponent captures all the victory points, they get 3 bonus victory points, and come back from behind and win the game. So that's just something I want to touch on there, that was a huge instrumental change, I'd say bigger than the one you touched on, but it is something where a lot of the changes in second edition are these, what I call them, the scalpel changes, where they come in and just tweak a tiny little like one sentence change, not really adding complexity to the game, but just making it a better product at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I would like to hammer home this point of gaming the game, because I don't think that's a problem per se. The question is, what is the intention of the game? How is it supposed to be played? And if you do have a game in which blocking your enemy is the point of the game, like if you play a game of Go, of course you are blocking your enemies. But if you play a game like Company of Heroes, where you have tanks on the field and squads, and you can command artillery strikes, winning this by blocking someone is, it's feeling wrong. And you do not want a game to feel wrong. That is what is putting people off. You know, they will say, yeah, it's a good game, but it doesn't feel good. And this can be a huge problem. And I think all the rules essentially should be judged always in this context. Like, does it further the intended play experience? Does it bring about what you want players to feel? This is an even more important problem in tabletop RPGs, which is more my area of expertise, because I do a lot of variants for my own favorite TTRPG system, and we are always asking this question, you know, how can you get the outcome of a rule to you more closely to the intended outcome, and then it doesn't matter if people question something. And as you said, it takes a lot of playtesting and thinking about it, and a lot of tweaking and trying stuff out. I'm always getting a little bit aggravated when I read on a Discord when someone comes in like to play the game one time, and then they're saying like, oh, this and this needs to be changed like this. And it's a fundamental change to the game, like the rules for Overwatch, which is machine guns doing damage to units moving through the firing arc. And I'm like, dude, how many games did you play? The designers of this game played quite a lot, you know, they have an idea of what they're doing. And I'm always trying, when I'm posing questions like this, I'm always assuming I'm not understanding the design intention. I don't know if you ever noticed this, but when I post, when I talk about this stuff on the Discord, I'm usually saying, like, I do not understand what the intention is. Can you explain that to me? Because then usually it becomes much more clear how rules are going to be interpreted. If the designer makes their intentions known, like if I know from reading the rule book or from the presentation of the game alone what the desired outcome is of any gameplay experience, I find it much harder to adjudicate rules. Because this happens all the time in games, especially in complex games. You are not sure how something works. You open the rule book, the rule text reads ambiguous to you, and you do not know exactly how to resolve something. And the more clear it is to me what the intended design goal is, and the better constructed the game is, because only a well-constructed game actually adheres to its design principles, if that makes any sense, then I can adjudicate rules better. And I know that you want the game to flow as seamlessly as possible. So if there are two conflicting results for any rule, I will go with the one that leads to more dynamic gameplay. And that is very helpful, I find.
I think that's a great example. I mean, I think I just want to kind of touch on a little bit. Yeah, I think the most frustrating is someone who hasn't tried the game or seen the game. We had some of those individuals come in and say, oh, I want it this way because some other game does it this way, or you sometimes get that. And it's like, okay, like, yeah, you know, like kind of you're touching on, make your like play the game you want. Like at the end of the day, I certainly want like experience, you know, there's a lot of experienced gamers out there and this is like close to what they want. And they don't like, you know, say my vision of the game, like you're touching on, or what the intention is. And they want it to be something different. Usually it's more complex because it's better, you know, less abstracted, more realism and more historical. That's a lot of feedback that we get. And it's tough making a war game, right? Because a lot of people, especially in the wargaming industry, you know, wargamers, they want things to a certain degree to their liking that is, you know, historical and stuff. And sometimes, you know, it depends on what the objectives of the game are, right? Kind of like the of the design. So like, for instance, I say balance is number one, right? So that's over historical, right? So it's like for us, for Company Heroes, it's balance, then it is matching the video game, then it's historical, right? Because this is of an IP, right? So we need to be matching the IP, and the IP isn't perfectly historical. It might be more historical here or there in some ways, right? But it's trying to make a representation. It's abstracting things. It's trying to make, you know, cater to that user experience of their product, right? So in a lot of ways, yeah, so you get things across the board like that, for sure.
One of the most misused and misunderstood words, I think, in game context is realism. What people usually mean is, and do I pronounce this right, verisimilitude? I think you know what I mean. It's this very complicated word that I always write wrong, spell wrong. But it has to feel right, you know? And I do not like this whole aspect of you need to tweak the balancing so that it confirms to what you think was the historical reality, which if you ask any historian, which I happen to be, is unknowable in many times anyway, or very relative of specific time frames, etc. Like, I hate it so much when people go on like, oh, the Panzer IV was like this, you have a Panther tank, so it needs to do exactly that, or be superior to that unit in that regard, and it's just bullshit most of the time. And even if it wasn't, I don't care. I want a good game, not a Panther simulator. There are games out there for this, and there are many games out there for this, and I don't like them. And there are very few games like Company of Heroes, which is why I'm so glad that you stick to your guns on that question, because many people, I think, go in the wrong direction here.
Well, I mean, it's what the game design's trending to do, right? A lot of people, a lot of wargamers are looking for that, right? So it is a tough line, right? Because... And I don't blame them, right? That they're entitled to their own, you know,
absolutely
what their opinions are and what they're, you know, what they want out of a game. And that's perfectly fine.
My point is there are a lot of war games out there. So the game they want exists. They exist quite a lot of them. Whereas the game that you made does not exist yet. And so I have little patience with people who are demanding that you make it more in the direction of what is already out there and essentially take away my toy. You know what I mean?
I know what you're saying, but I think it's fair. Like, you know,
absolutely.
I slightly disagree with you in some way here that, you know, it is the vision of the designer at the end of the day, but it is also trying to make a game. That's kind of the tough thing, right? Because you are trying to make a game at the end of the day that people are going to enjoy, right? So that's also why I just try to, you know, anytime anyone mentions it to me, oh, hey, why didn't you have a rule this way? I'd prefer the rule to be this way. I'd be like, test it out, play it. If you want it that way, if you have more enjoyment, that's the point of a game at the end of the day, is to have fun, right? And enjoy the experience. You know, especially when a game like this, where you want that, you know, whether you play it solo or if you're playing with another individual, is just having that experience that you're looking for. And I think here it is a great system where you can tweak it, right? So like a perfect example is kind of close to what you were saying there, was the Panther IV versus the Tiger tank, right? For Wehrmacht. And it's like, you're going to look at the stats and say, why does the Tiger tank only have 2 range versus you made the Panzer IV in second edition have 3 range. Well, a lot of it is from a game designer perspective, is we only have so many dials to tweak, right? So like, first of all, in first edition, all the kind of the medium main battle tanks all had speed dice, right? So they all felt the same. When you're actually playing the game, they felt the same. They're used the same. And that's kind of boring, right? So it's not very interesting when you're going faction to faction and playing, you know, how does this unit feel different from that unit? You want every unit to feel different.
Yeah, and that is a difficult thing to do. And I do like all these changes once again. I am always glad that I did not back the first edition, that I backed only the second, because if there hadn't been a second edition, I feel like I would have been disappointed. I wouldn't have played it so often and most likely sold it, like the person from which I bought my set, and then since then printed all the second edition material myself. All those changes, I like them, and I think you made a much better game out of it, which is why I wanted to do this discussion in the first place, like trying to find out and get into your headspace a little bit and into the designing principles. One last question, maybe. Do you feel under pressure from the community? Do you find it hard to say no to people and to stick to your guns, even in the face of opposition?
I think it's tough because I think initially as a designer, I think one of the things you have to learn is to have an open mind and try to understand their perspective. And sometimes I will say no, and then I'll change later. Right. So it's like, all right. So I always say to people, hey, you think something's broken? Show me. Right. Cause maybe I haven't seen that example, or maybe I haven't, you know, seen that experience yet. I mean, even after our hundreds of games of watching, like, hey, well, give me a scenario where this occurs, and they might give me one specific scenario, and it's like, okay, well, this is too rare. This is like a 1 in 1 million scenario. Is it, you know, is it worth changing? And that's certainly tough, right? And that's something where, you know, sometimes you got to find the line, right? So I think with game designs in particular, it really is like at the end of the day, I think that's where some game designs kind of suffer, is they're kind of catering sometimes to an audience and then they lose the vision. So, you know, it's unfortunate when that happens, because sometimes you run into, you know, just aspects of development where, you know, you're listening to too much feedback and you're getting torn too many directions. At the end of the day, you need to have that clear cut vision of what a product needs to be. What the, like, because I think a lot of people do appreciate that, right? So like, people that appreciate, like you're saying, hey, I don't want the product to change, right? Like, I already expect this and this, right? So once you set those goals and expectations of, here's the scope, here's the goal of what this design's trying to accomplish, you kind of want to adhere to it, right? So I think at the end of the day, I think that's a tough line to walk, but I think the key thing is to keep an open ear. Maybe try it out. I think that's one great thing with game design, is until it's shipped, you can try it out. Unfortunately, with physical products, once it's shipped, it's done, right? I mean, that's one thing Chris, you know, touched on with me. He's like, are you ready for it to ship? And I'm like, yeah. And then, like, you know, still to this, you know, these last second tweaks, I'm like, all right, this little thing, let's, like, you know, lately, like, for instance, like OKW, I'm like, all right, let's do this slight little change. because, you know, I want to just lower their win rate a little bit, or like a little bit too more, slightly still too powerful in this scenario. So it's little cases like that where, you know, at some point this is it, and we're pretty much at that wire here. We're wrapping up production, and once it goes to print, I'm done, right? I got to step away, and that's it. The product has to stand on its own. So
it's pretty tough. And I wish you the best of luck for this whole endeavor. I can't wait to hold it in my hands myself. Thank you, Brian, very much for this talk. It was a very enlightening discussion.
Well, again, thanks for having me.
If you like this podcast, you can support us via PayPal at paypal.me/boiledleather, or you go over to our Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleather audio hour. Patreon offers many subscription tiers, which give you early access to episodes, the possibility to weigh in on topic choices, bonus podcasts like the Boiled Leather Audio Moment or the Boiled Leather Audio Conversation, and of course, the possibility to be mentioned right in the beginning of every podcast. Hop over to patreon.com/boiledleather audio hour or contribute over PayPal at paypal.me/boiledleather.